Hi folks, welcome to episode 75 of the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters. I'm joined by Beau, and we are going to be continuing our discussion on William the Conqueror, what he did after Hastings, because of course he's had his difficult early life. He seems to have some claim to the crown of England, even if it's weak. He has come over, he has defeated Harold Godwinson. Fortunately for William, Godwinson died at the battle, so that's that problem solved. And now he just has to bring England to heel.
Right, which is no small feat.
Mm.
And in fact, one of the chroniclers, one of the French chroniclers, I think William of Jumièges, says, after the Battle of Hastings, all England was conquered. And everyone at the time, and all obviously modern scholars, don't even laugh at that. It's risible. It's absolutely risible. Yeah. Because the next 20 years, William goes on to live for another 20-odd years, is just lots and lots and lots and lots of rebellions. That's what this story is going to be about. And in fact, you know, the story isn't really resolved properly, the sort of tensions between Anglos and Normans, until the days of John, King John.
Yeah.
So, and in some small ways, still struggle with it today.
Well,
in a very small sense.
Honestly, you could probably argue that the Labour Party and the Conservative Party could be framed as Anglo-Saxon versus Norman. I'm not even joking.
Well, yeah.
I'm not even joking. If you look at the average membership and trace their lineage back, I bet if you were to check the surnames, there's a preponderance of French surnames in the Conservative Party and a preponderance of Anglo-Saxon surnames in the Labour Party. I'm not even joking.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, that is a thing that the historians have looked at. For example, in the in the Battle of Bosworth Field in 1485. Historians love to look at that and see what Norman names are there and which ones aren't. And one of the things modern scholars talk about a lot is where earldoms and bishoprics aren't changed for Norman, swapped out for Normans.
Yeah.
But we can get into all of that.
Right.
So last time we left off with the end of the battle, didn't we? And so just, I suppose, one of the first things to say about Harold, some say he was buried correctly in consecrated ground, but most say his remains, what left of them, because they were probably mutilated, well, they were mutilated, was buried on just a sort of a random cliff overlooking the shore, because that was part of, that's meant to be sort of ironic, or a final posthumous slap in the face, that you were supposed to protect the Anglo-Saxon shore.
Mm.
Well, now you can look out over it forever, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that was said was that he was so mutilated, particularly his face, that no one could really identify him. They had to get his mother, or possibly his mistress, Edith the Swan-necked, who there were certain marks on his body that he could be identified by. But just to mention then, his mother, Gytha, her name was. Of course, her husband, Godwin, is already passed away.
Yeah.
And she'd lost Tostig at Stamford Bridge. And she'd lost Harold, of course.
And then his two brothers as
And there were another two brothers, another of her two sons, Leothwyn and Gyrith.
Yeah.
So in very short order, she'd lost four sons, three in one day.
Yeah.
And so you can imagine,
she can't have too many left. I mean, that's got to be all.
There are some.
Oh, are there?
And I think there's one more of her sons, but all these men have got children of their own.
Right.
And then later, the grandchildren of Godwine come into it.
Right, okay.
And she, even her, she herself becomes sort of a lightning rod for rebellions and things.
Right.
Because she seems to be a formidable person.
Yeah.
And she comes into it in her own right a bit. I mentioned the Malfos, didn't I? This trench, this sort of ditch on the other side of Senlac Hill, where lots of Normans fell. We're told there was high grass concealed an ancient rampart there.
Hmm.
William of Poitiers says of the battlefield of Hastings that far and wide the earth was covered with the flower of the English nobility and youth, drenched in blood. Because that's one of the things that also comes up a lot, especially from sort of the religious side of things, the ecclesiastical side of things, is that even for the 11th century, it was particularly bloody, apparently. Mm. It was particularly gruesome. And that this sort of... This idea of sort of blood guilt William could never wash himself clean of it, no matter how many abbeys he founded or monasteries he endowed.
Surprised, because you think the 11th century is a pretty bloody place.
Well, yeah. Hopefully.
This is not a very nice place. There are a lot of nasty things happening.
Hopefully we'll get into it towards the end of this one, or maybe in the next one. But apparently, for the 11th century, despite all the blindings and mutilations I've spoken of, apparently William was less murderous than the Vikings, the Anglo-Saxons, other people in France. Modern scholars say, we see sort of the first concepts of chivalry coming in. It didn't really apply to normal people, but if you're an earl or something, you'd quite often merely be imprisoned for life, or even pardoned. Which is funny, because you think of William the Conqueror as extremely brutal, and he was in many ways.
On the field, but actually afterwards, I don't feel I don't have the impression of him being an excessively cruel ruler. No. Even though he kind of was, actually.
By our standards, insanely cruel.
Well, obviously,
by our standards. By those standards, he could have been worse. But we'll get into that. Because sometimes he's capricious, though, I'll say that. Yeah. You never really knew what he might do, what mood he might be in. A bit like Alexander. We've said this before about Alexander, haven't we? If you catch him in the wrong mood, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
Catch him in the right mood, he's unbelievably clement. he's like that. He really is a bit like that. Because none of these things are really written in law. You know,
he's the king.
Right. 11th century king. Yeah. It's not like, say, in the 18th or 19th century, there's law and the king can't do what he wants. The king has to abide by the laws.
This is long before that.
Yeah. And we're told that William does, though, leave a lot of dead on the field at Hastings, sort of deliberately, as another kind of slap in the face.
Yeah.
Presumably
to intimidate the English.
Yeah. And Poitiers says that the bodies of the dead, of the English dead, were left to be eaten by worms and wolves, by birds and dogs.
Hmm.
Now, of course, it's a big physical task to bury thousands of people. And yet still, some efforts would usually be made. Or you'd let families come and get their dead. Which he did a bit, but not entirely. Again, it's sort of a symbolic thing to have them eaten by dogs and things. As I say, some say Harold was buried on this cliff top. Seems a bit poetic. Others say he was buried at Waltham Abbey. Just as simple as that. He's at Waltham Abbey. Now, that's
could,
the thing...
Could be either, couldn't it? I mean,
right. That's the thing that's going to come up loads in this story, and probably the next epochs, is that there's quite often two versions of things, two stories of things. And we just don't know. Or quite often I'll say, this happened, we think, we don't know, we can only infer. Or there's one line from the Chronicle, or there's one line from the Carmen that tells us this, and it's shaky.
It's the way it is.
Yeah. So just to say on that, as I usually do fairly early on about the sources and sort of the historiography of it, we are quite, although there's a fair bit, we're certainly not sort of flying blind by any stretch of the imagination. We are still, though, there is still relatively a dearth of information. So even 100, 150 years after this, we've got tons more. We've got so much more. One of the things I've said in one of my other videos on my channel, I've certainly said it before, but I'll say it again because it's sort of perfect thing to say right now, is that in the age of Edward the First and Second and Third, we know from sort of bureaucracy, from rolls, the royal rolls and things, we sort of know, historians can sort of piece together, researchers can say sort of exactly where they were and what they were doing.
Yeah.
For William the Conqueror, it's like 20-odd times in 20 years, you can say, right, he was here on this date doing this. And the rest of it is all sort of up for grabs, so to speak.
Yeah.
What they would have is charters. Quite often a Christmas charter or an Easter charter or a royal writ. And it's signed by William himself and some of his entourage.
So you
at
know
a
he was
place,
in this particular
and it's
place.
Dated, yeah. And other than that, it's all sort of shrouded a little bit in mysteries a bit much, but you know, it's opaque.
Well, it's in the fog of history, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's interesting you point out that only a few hundred years later, actually, the records that we have are amazing. Like we know all of the names of Henry V's soldiers. We have the royal muster rolls, and how much they were paid and how many of them were, even down, like I said, to their names. And it's like, that is an incredible level of bureaucracy that is been preserved, but it speaks to the historical continuity of the place, doesn't it?
Yeah, and there's a few leaps up in it. So, for example, in the age of Henry II, which isn't long after this at all, there seems to be a big jump in sort of paperwork.
Mm.
And then Edward III, and then by the time of Henry V, sort of the very early 15th century, we know everything, almost. Yeah. Well, that's an exaggeration, but like you get the names of individual peasants, like Davy Gam, a Welsh archer. Yeah. We know exactly what he did and how much he was paid, where he went and when, and all of it.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. And so here were some of the same old names, Aldric Vitalis, William Protier, William of Malmesbury, John of Worcester, Simeon of Durham comes up, a churchman. There's the D&E Chronicle. We've got, I mentioned one of his sort of main churchman, a Lanfranc. He sent lots of letters back and forth with the Pope, Alexander, and a lot of them survive, incredibly.
Right. Yeah.
So we've got Lanfranc's letters, which is incredible, because it's someone speaking directly to us from the 11th century, which is, for historians, absolute gold dust.
Yeah.
There's a few other, Henry of Huntingdon, and there's also the Domesday Book, which will start coming into it. Because not long after this, people can start, because the Domesday Book is until the 1080s. It's only a couple of years before William dies.
Yeah, it's quite a long time off from.
Yeah, but you can still say, it says this in the Domesday Book, so we can sort of extrapolate that even 20 years before or 100 years before, it must or must not have been the case that X, Y, Z.
Mm.
We can start doing that. Mm. Anyway, that's the job of the historian.
Mm.
All very interesting to me, but we'll leave it there because it's not everyone's cup of tea, that sort of thing. Okay. So William is now, at least in his own mind, or in the minds of his followers, is the King of England. He's just killed the King of England, won a giant, sort of fairly obviously decisive pitched battle. And yet nothing's over. He controls the southeast of England.
Yeah.
That's it, really.
Not even in London.
No, especially not in London, actually. So loads of the survivors, and there were a few thousand at least survivors from Hastings, go back to London. And then there was also the brother earls of Mercia and Northumbria, Edwin and Morcar, finally reached London about this time. So apparently the streets of London are sort of still thronging with Anglo-Saxon warriors, another whole army to some degree, to some extent. So, absolutely nothing's over. And London, even then, was sort of strongly girded, as they say.
Well, yeah.
It's got walls, big, strong,
everything
impenetrable walls.
yeah.
Yeah. London is absolutely a formidable task to try and take it. And so William and as I say, his entourage, some of the main people is William Fitzosborne is one of the main architects, they keep saying, and his own half-brother, Odo of Bayeux, Bishop of Bayeux, there's a few others. They sort of have to make a decision. Are we going to try and besiege London, sack London? And they realise it's not really possible. Mark Morris says that William... one of the original chroniclers said that William, quote, preferred to act more moderately.
Well, it's because you might have lost.
Yeah. But also there, it's true, it's okay. Mm. But also kind of nonsense, because everything William's doing here is not moderate.
No.
There's nothing moderate about any of this.
No, but
it's maybe calculated risk management, but it's not moderate.
Yeah, I mean, you know? Yeah. Excuse me. I mean, prudently would have been a better word to use there. But, like, he doesn't have the manpower to spend on a siege, so.
Right, yeah, a big, massive siege like that. I mean, it's just like Hannibal at the gates of Rome.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, you can conquer all of Spain and southern France and northern Italy and beat multiple Roman armies at their best, but you can't besiege Rome. That's a whole other thing. You need almost a nation of people, something like that, to do that.
Because for anyone who doesn't know, the thing about walls is that they're called force multipliers, and you are going to lose a lot of men trying to storm them.
And if your walls are very, very good,
then
you look at Byzantium.
Yeah. It
took 1,000 years to take that,
you
know,
just
because their walls were so great, sort of the walls of Theodosius. Mm. The day apparently William camps on the ridge at Senlac Hill, where Battle Abbey is.
Right.
One very quick note I'll say about that, because someone left a comment on one of the YouTube videos, and it's a fair comment, saying it's not Senlac Hill, it's some other hill. And I have seen that said, because there's sort of minimal archaeology showing that a battle happened there. So that's sort of a fair enough thing to say. However, why would William build a Battle Abbey on the wrong hill? Because Battle Abbey certainly dates from 1070, 1071.
I mean, it's not like he wasn't there.
Exactly.
So
it's just a bit odd. But that's the way history is quite often. Like the field at Agincourt, there doesn't seem to be any death pits there or thousands of arrowheads lying around when you do the archaeology. So what's going on?
I've always wondered about this. Like, because, I mean, there's just essentially an unlimited amount of time afterwards for peasants or whoever's come and scavenge anything from the battlefield, right? So, like, it's entirely possible that, like, over, you know, the next year or two, just, you know, thousands of people have come there and been like, right, great, stuff I can salvage and sell,
you know? Yeah. Well, at least, you're absolutely right, 100% right. Ravaging the bodies for anything valuable, that's absolutely de rigueur. That's absolutely what would happen after every battle, is that anything at least of value is sort of taken away, sort of straight away, really.
Yeah, there's no reason to leave the next day.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're leaving money on the table, so to speak. Why would you do that? But we're told that the very next day is something like a chase, and that's always bloody, isn't it? But we're also told the Normans suffered a bit because the remaining Anglo-Saxons do something like a fighting retreat. I hesitate to call it that. But there's still a lot of blood. It was Mark Morris who said that the next day, perhaps as many people died as in the battle.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So it seems like we can only really infer it's sort of a very chaotic thing. Anyway, eventually, William and his army... sorry, I'm jumping ahead slightly. So William is, we're told, was preferred to act moderately. And so he waits sort of around the southeast coast of England for a while, like a good couple of weeks. And he expects the great men, the remaining magnates, to come to him and bend the knee. And he waits and he waits and no one turns up. You can sort of imagine from his point of view and his camp are like... Really? We thought this is done, you know. We thought we'd, you know.
Yeah, the king's dead. We've defeated you in a big battle. Come on, just come and surrender.
But they won't.
No.
So Morcar and Edwine and the other, and Stigand, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and all the other magnates, there's many more, we know some of their names, they sort of have a witan, it's not really a full witan, but they proclaim Edgar the Aetheling to be the new king, who is, you know, directly in the line of, he's in the House of Wessex, the House of... of Alfred and the Confessor and everything.
Right, so he's got a better claim than William there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In one of the...
Jimmy doesn't have a better army than William.
Yeah. Well, he's still a teenager.
Right, okay.
He's still a teenager. Yeah. I think he's not a young teenager, but he's not...
Yeah, yeah.
Not a full-blown actor in his own right still. He does go on to live for a long time and have an interesting life, very interesting life. The ups and downs of his fortunes are sort of quite remarkable. And so so it seems at this window of time that the English, the Anglo-Saxons, in their minds, they're thinking, okay, nothing's over here. Maybe we can perhaps even have another battle and maybe turning back. It's all still to play for, basically, in their minds. But so in the end, William realises, well, it's a pretty simple choice. I've either got to go home.
Yeah.
I've got to push on. But he's sort of already, not at his limit, but he's lost quite a few guys. Some of them are beginning to, there's a little bit of dysentery. Because they're foraging, but you can only do that for so long in the same area before all the food runs out, as simple as that.
Yeah.
So he pushes on towards London, goes through Canterbury, but they don't take Stigand hostage or anything because he's not there, he's in London.
Right, right.
And they get to basically the South Bank because back then London
was not just a giant sprawling metropolis. It was actually a contained city.
Yeah, the walled London was entirely north of the River Thames.
Yeah.
Whereas nowadays it's massive and sprawling.
Yeah.
And so they get to basically, London Bridge and the South Bank, where today it's sort of theatre land. And the London Eye around there. And they do try, they line up their cavalry a bit, some Norman knights to try and push across the bridge. But the men of London repel that, which is sort of something, isn't it? Because the Norman cavalry is supposed to be something very formidable, something approaching.
There's no question of it. And so that is impressive that they can push them back.
But perhaps to be funneled across a bridge,
not advantageous to them.
And so they're pushed back. And so the leadership, William and his men, make the decision, we could keep trying this. Could keep trying, you know, maybe we could try make siege engines and all sorts of things, but they decide it's just not feasible. Whatever reason, they decide it's just not feasible. We're not sure if William the Conqueror as well was waiting for or had hoped for more reinforcements from Normandy. Again, this is what it's like. One of the chronicles says he is, and the other one makes no mention. The other ones make no mention whatsoever of that.
I think it's plausible.
So, it's completely
plausible that he is.
Yeah.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.